Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Welcome to Beyond the Book, and a very special edition we have as a prelude to the upcoming conference of the Society of Scholarly Publishing in Boston, their annual meeting, May 28th through the 30th, 2008. My name is Chris Keneally. I'm Director of Author Relations for the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center. We have some very special guests from the world of publishing, talking about some issues that I think are worth following very closely, and particularly for the group that will be attending SSP. We are especially proud of what's happening here in Boston this year. That is our hometown, of course. As I like to tell people, it's hard to tell, but I am from Boston and very delighted to see a group like that come to the city. But our colleague at Copyright Clearance Center, Sue Kestner, who's the Director of Publisher Services, is the current president of SSP and has organized, I think, a terrific conference looking at everything from the deep history of the information age with Alex Wright from the New York Times to green publishing, what publishers can do for environmental sustainability, and as well subjects such as working in global markets and beyond books and journals delivering non-traditional content that users want. Joining me right now is Chuck Hemingway. Welcome, Chuck.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Chuck is the partner manager for Copyright Clearance Center and, as such, is involved in working with a number of businesses to build opportunities for new revenue potential in publishing. And Chuck, we've got a couple of people that you're working with joining us right now. The first is John Sack, who is the director for Highwire Press. John, welcome.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Chuck. Nice to be with you today.
Very glad to have you, John. And John is, as I say, director of Highwire Press, which is an enterprise of Stanford University. And its mission is ensuring the continued success of independent, society-based, and scientific publishers as they continue their effort in a very changing world to get high-quality content published and disseminated as widely as possible. And you're all about trying to explore new ideas and find ways to innovate solutions that meet the challenge of, if I can say, for the thousandth time, digital revolution, John, right?
That's it.
And so as we look at that, a question occurs to me about way that publishing is taking on new forms. And we've seen a shift in the music world from the package, the CD, the album, to the single song, certainly seeing that in iTunes, where you don't have to buy the whole CD and the jewel box and everything that goes with it. You can just buy the tune you like. And so I wonder, tell us what you see from Highwire's perspective. Is that happening as well where the package is the scholarly journal? Are we moving to a delivery mechanism that lets people buy the article or something even smaller than that?
Well, that's right, Chris. It's definitely a transformation that's begun. There are a number of ways of reaching new customers and giving them closer and closer targeting ability to decide what it is they want to buy, whether they want to buy an article, even a part of an article, like a figure, whether they want to buy multiple copies because they want reprints, whether they want classroom use, and so on. There are really a number of ways that have been evolving over the last 10 years of monetization and the ways to reach new customers. Let me talk a little about the traditional types that we've seen, and then I'll talk about the newer forms that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years with the rise of the search engines and other types of distribution. And then I'll comment some on the what I see on the horizon, which is really where, to go back to your question, we see the influence of other industries coming into academic publishing and some of the models that we've got there.
Terrific.
So, traditionally, we've really had indirect and direct monetization. Basically indirect, it's through monetizing traffic. And you think about who is it who values the traffic, because that's how you're going to monetize it. And a lot of people value the traffic in an academic journal site. Of course, you know, we think of the value that the readers have, but others, authors value the traffic because, of course, they are the ones who want the readers. Editors value the traffic because they want to know what the readers are reading. Librarians value it because they're looking at usage statistics to decide what it is that they should renew or cancel. And, of course, the readers, especially in the Web 2.0 world, value the traffic. And over the last couple of years, probably starting from around, I guess, 2002, 2003, traffic has increasingly been coming from search engines, Google primary among them, but even before Google, there was PubMed for the biomedical journals, and more recently, there's been Google Scholar. And within the Highwire collection, I'd say about half the traffic that the journals get comes from outside of the journal itself. That is, not someone typing in a URL and going directly to an article. I'm sorry, going directly to a journal homepage, but instead they're going directly to an article from a search result in Google or PubMed. There are also other ways that we've been bringing traffic in, and that's through tables of contents, alerts, and RSS feeds, and interjournal links. And all these happen at the article level.
And that all just is to ensure that as many people as possible find the content.
Right. The key, the mantra, if you will, is to put the track onto the content wherever the user is.
Right.
So rather than hoping the user will find their way to the content because they're good scholars and good researchers, you really have to put it in a place that they're going to come across it. And so you have to put it where they are. If they're using Google, you have to put it in Google. If they're using email, you have to put it in their email. If they're reading articles, you have to put it in the reference linking.
Right.
These are the typical ways we've been doing it for years now.
And then once they have it, you want to be able to make it possible for them to use it in the way they want to.
Right. And so with a lot of the journals we've worked with, we have something called toll-free interjournal links. So if a researcher is looking at one article, they can have access to other articles that are cited in that article if they're within the Highwire family. And the researchers just love that. And it brings more traffic in. So in the end, the editors like it, the librarians like it, the publishers like it. Everyone's pretty happy with that. There's the direct forms of monetization over the years have been growing. You know, with a lot of advertising, there is a commercial opportunity for some journals. It's probably not for all journals. It's the journals where an advertiser sees some value in the particular audience they're looking at. We've seen new types of ads, interactive ads, multimedia ads, interstitial ads. We've seen new placements for ads. And I think that probably for the first 5 or so years of online journals, the advertising, the editorial community was nervous about putting ads on content pages. But I think that's been shifting. We now have good designs that just make advertising spaces distinctive. So they are like you'd see them in a print magazine now. And, of course, we've got ad targeting possibilities now through the user demographics and content demographics. In other words, when I come into a website, it knows something about what I'm interested in based on what I'm reading. And so ads can be targeted that way, just as Google does, really. It's the way Google makes its money. Now, we're seeing newer forms of advertising coming up, just as we're reaching new customers with some new tools like RSS feeds and widgets. These can have ads on them, so you can monetize use of the feeds and the widgets, bring new traffic in directly from these new forms of delivery. And what's most important about those forms, the RSS feeds and the widgets, the email alerts, et cetera, is that they're moving the content out to where the user is. That's really essential, I think, for the digital native, is that they come across this, they don't have to go somewhere else in order to do their work.
And also on the other end, the people sending out the content know that person wants it, rather than kind of just shooting it out there and hoping it hits somebody, actually very much targeting it to those users that are the ones they're after.
Yeah, that's really right, Chris. You know, what every advertiser wants, and frankly what every editor wants, is a well-qualified reader.
Right.
And that's really what you have with these forms, essentially where the user has asked for a type of advertising. And advertising isn't limited to commercial ads, or it's not even limited to house ads. It can be, you can advertise your own content in your other content, and that's increasingly what we see publishers doing. You know, the recommendation services that we're all familiar with Amazon and so on, are really just forms of recommending content to people based on other content they're reading.
Right. In fact, you said what I was going to say. It's just very much the same experience as we have with an Amazon.
It really is. I was surprised last week. I was doing a search for a gag gift for someone in Amazon. I was looking for a solar-powered hat, you know, one of those hats with a little built-in fan.
Uh-huh.
And so one day I searched in Amazon. Or actually, I searched in Google, and Amazon had one of the entries in Google. I clicked on it. I looked at what Amazon had, and I clicked away. The next morning, I had an email from Amazon all about solar-powered devices. And it was clear that they've been watching me. You know, I had an auto sign-in to Amazon, so it could tell right away and how to send an email back to me telling me all the things they had that would interest me. And I think it's entirely possible for publishers to do that. There's really no rocket science involved. It's just it's starting to imagine your business as an online business, like Amazon's, rather than a print business.
Absolutely. And let me bring Chuck into the conversation just briefly. And Chuck, can you tell us about how you, meaning Copyright Clearance Center, and Highwire are working together to take advantage of this and to do just what John has mentioned, and that is to recognize that online is itself a world of opportunity when it comes to publishing?
Well, thanks for asking, Chris. For folks that aren't familiar with the Clearance Center, one of the things that we do is we have a partner program. We call it the Rights Connect Partner Program, and that's where we work with solution providers, folks that provide high-value applications and solutions into the market for content users and content providers. And one of the ways that we work together is to provide copyright licensing utilities where the content resides, or where it makes sense for the content user to have a need for a copyright utility. And we worked with Highwire to develop a utility that rides alongside the content in the toolbar. So if folks do have an opportunity to, or a need rather, to ask for a figure, a table, a graph, or maybe they have a need to make photocopies or something very simple, email content, that they have tools available to legally obtain the right. And in doing so, it also creates a revenue for the publisher, which we think is a great thing, because there are a lot of publishers, some that, like John had mentioned, that may not need high-powered commerce on their content, but could still benefit from being able to collect a royalty here and there.
Oh, absolutely.
For the costs of publishing.
Absolutely. I mean, and John, tell me whether you agree, but I mean, I think the investment that all these journals are making in creating this content in the first place is something that they hope will provide returns to them over time.
Oh, absolutely. It's really important, the tools that Chuck was just talking about. It's very important that you put the tools that people need to use the content in the appropriate way right where the content is. One of the things we found with the copyright clearance integration that Chuck was just talking about is that before we put that into our sites, it was relatively hard for a reader to do what they needed to do to get permission, to clear a copyright, to get copies of something made legally. And these tools just make it essentially a click. And, you know, the world of the university, you really do pay attention to intellectual property. You want to do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And by simplifying that, I think we made it much more, well, first, visible. I think that's an important thing, is that the whole idea of permissions, it can be invisible to the reader on many websites. But we not only made it visible, we made it so that you can really complete the transaction sitting there at your desktop. And I think that's pretty important.
Right. I think the point you're making about make it visible and make it possible really go hand in hand. Thank you, John, very much. John Sack, director of High Wire Press. And welcome now, Joel Bush. Joel is from Near Time. Joel, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And Joel, you've been listening to what John Sack has had to say, and I wonder whether you think the same is true with the book publishing world. Are we seeing new ways of looking at the package? I mean, the package remains in the printed world, but what I heard someone from Google actually call the offline content. Offline content is still the book from your perspective, but when we go to online, it's easy to break that book apart. Are people doing that, and in what ways does Near Time help them organize that and work with that?
Yeah, I think there's quite a bit of similarities between what John was talking about in journals and what trade book and academic publishers are trying to do online right now. One of the biggest things, and to your point, is the fact that publishing online, making content available online, makes it much easier for the publisher to extend that experience. Whether extending that experience means adding rich media such as movies or audio, or if extending that experience means letting that reader discover other readers who are interested in the same topic, and in that way bringing sort of a social aspect to it. It's all coming back to the economics. And the print and ship world, as you guys can imagine, is experiencing a lot of trouble these days with, the cost of gas going up and with people's constant online access, making that content and communities around that content available to people at a discounted price seems to be gaining quite a bit of momentum.
And what Near Time's application does, it's rather ingenious, is the way that it allows the contributors, the readers, and all the various participants in the publishing process to collaborate.
That's right. And Chris, that is driven largely by some features of the platform where the administrators actually control the roles and permissions that everyone within that space has. Near Time consists of a blog, a wiki, a forum, and a number of other Web 2.0 components. But just because it's in a wiki doesn't mean it's Wikipedia, where you're turning your content over to be democratically vetted by anyone and everyone with a browser. You do have the ability to maintain your content integrity as authoritative content and build community around that. Let people participate by commenting on that page, asking questions in the forum, rating the page, and discovering other users with similar interests.
And just as John Sack was talking about traffic being important in all its various aspects, what you've done here is kind of organize the traffic, control the traffic, if you will. Is that a good way to think of it?
Yeah, I think so. It's really producing focused sites, whether those sites are around a group of titles or an individual title. It's not the iTunes model where people are buying and downloading one chapter. They're buying a subscription to a site, and that site generally contains the entire contents of the book and other things that extend that experience. So in that regard, yeah, we're monetizing content online, but it's not pay per sip in that.
Right. It's a different look at that. But still, the delivery is not the traditional one, which is another point that John had made. How are you working with Copyright Clearance Center?
We have done a light integration with CCC, and publishers who use NearTime to put content out there can very easily add the CCC button at the page level or at the site level so that people can easily click through to Rights Connect and see what rights are available for that particular publication and then proceed through the Rights Connect to secure those rights.
Which, again, is an echo of John's comment about making the potential for reuse or for licensing, whatever the need is, visible and then making it possible. And
that's right.
Really important to the publishers. As you say, while it's true that the print world is experiencing its own pressures right now around, the remaining an economical model, at the same time, it's still a challenge for a lot of people to find the sweet spot online that's going to provide the revenue they need.
Exactly.
Well, I think, Chris, that let me jump in on Joel's comment.
Yeah, sure, John, please.
I really like his term, extending the experience. You asked me the question at the beginning about what can we learn from the music industry, and I think there are several industries now where we're seeing evolution of what it is that you buy. It's not the original package. It's an expanded kind of package. I was talking to a friend a week before last who is an important part of the architecture for iTunes, and he was telling me about the changes in the music industry. It's, what can be monetized? And it turns out that he said that people will pay for two things. They'll pay for authenticity and they'll pay for conversation. And by authenticity, what he meant is, in fact, people aren't buying albums. And really, they're paying so precious little for actual tracks that it almost doesn't count. What they really will pay good dollars for are live concerts. In fact, you probably read Madonna has decided that her next music series is really going to be distributed through Live Nation rather than through a traditional music publisher. So it's essentially live concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to authenticity, people paying for conversation. What he meant by that was fan clubs. And what people will pay for is time with the talent. A live conversation, a conversation with the real person making the real music, is part of what can be monetized. And I think both of these, for those of us who are in the academic publishing world, are part of extending the experience. Discovering more media, discovering more people who are interested in the media. I think it's very important to think about the changes in the music industry.
And Joel, that sounds something like what you're trying to do with the collaboration and the subscription model that people are purchasing through NearTime. Is that correct? That again, they're getting that conversation with the editors, with the authors, and the whole variety of people?
That's right. In fact, we've got a number of projects online right now that content is being released months ahead of the print edition. And in that window of time, the publishers and authors and editors are engaging the audience to get live customer reader feedback. They're saying, gosh, I love this section, but you need to cover more on this topic. You need to expand this. I disagree with that. And they're getting great insight before the product goes live from sort of that early adopter group of people that are, they either have a vested interest because their job depends on this content, or it's something that they're passionate about. And so they're getting real interaction with those people before the print product goes out. And, in our environment, one of the things that is neat and is really enabling this is the fact that it doesn't have to be perfect, where a print book has to be, it has to be vetted all the way before you can send something to the printer. You can get something 80-85% of the way there, put it up online, and let people start to interact and engage around that while you finish your process, whatever that might be.
And I would imagine that creates a sense of anticipation because they've participated in it. It's something that they've seen develop almost before their eyes, and so it's got some value because they've been following that process rather than it's a kind of take it or leave it when it's delivered to them, all finished, cut and dried.
Yeah, yeah. Making a comment to a publisher before something goes to press and knowing that it's going to affect the print product versus, you know, sending an email to a publisher after the book's been printed, you know that you're actually going to have an impact on the product at that point, and for that reason, you're probably more engaged.
Well, you could probably get the people who have participated in that conversation, that dialogue ahead of the print product, are sort of invested in it themselves.
You know, there you go.
When you do peer review on an article, you know, you take an interest in that article. If you think it's at all good, and
right.
At least my own experience, you can't wait until it actually gets published so you can share it with people.
That's right.
So those reviewers, if you will, become part of your distribution network. It's almost like viral marketing. If you can get them to send the an announcement of the publishing off to their friends.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, it's been a fascinating introduction to some of the subjects that people are going to have an opportunity to explore later this month at the 30th annual meeting of the Society for Scholarly Publishing. It'll be in Boston from May 28th to the 30th. Again, we are very proud that our colleague at Copyright Clearance Center, Sue Kessner, who is the president of SSP this year, and with her panel of contributors, has put together a terrific program. I want to thank Joel Bush for joining me. Joel's the director for sales at NearTime. Joel, thanks for being with us at Beyond the Book.
Of course. Thanks, Chris.
And I also want to thank John Sack, who is director for Highwire, which is an enterprise of Stanford University. John, thank you very much for being here today as well.
Thanks for the invitation and the conversation, Chris, and Chuck and Joel.
And I enjoyed it, and we hope that everybody will stop by and see the Highwire folks and Copyright Clearance Center presentation at the SSP conference. Joel, you'll be with me at Book Expo out in Los Angeles, so we hope to see all the audience at one of those two, Book Expo, running around the same time in Los Angeles, and SSP's annual meeting in Boston at the end of May. Thank you all again.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.